Welcome to Just Pure Laughs, the podcast all about clean comedy. I'm your host, Dan McGowan. I grew up in an entertainment family and have been working as a clean comedian for nearly 30 years. My experience includes comedy clubs, corporate events, cruise ships, community events, military and theater shows, and more. I'm a winner in the Branson Clean Comedy Contest. I've appeared in TV commercials and theater productions and recently filmed a Dry Bar Comedy special that you can find over there at drybarcomedy.com. In many ways, I've seen it all and always seem drawn back to comedy that everyone can enjoy. Clean comedy. So, if you enjoy comedy that is suitable for all ages and just want to learn more about clean comedy, stick around because it's time for Just Pure Laughs. Well, thanks for joining us today. I'm on with my guest and friend, Jeffrey Taylor. Hi, Jeffrey.
Hi, Dan. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Now, those who don't know, we both live in the Reading area. And Jeffrey, I'm sure you got hammered like I did with all that hail last night.
I may have slept through it.
That's great. The only person on the planet who can sleep through, you know, rocks of hail hitting the top of your home. That's good. That's good.
Well, every once in a while, the college experience catches back up with me again.
Yeah, got it. So Jeffrey, this is a podcast about clean comedy and primarily focusing on comedians. But you kind of do a double duty thing here, right? You're not just a comedian. Tell our listeners what else you do.
Well, I was an actor for a long time, which I did let get away from me. And when I moved back to the Reading area just a couple of years ago, I noticed that there was a large theater community. So I immediately jumped back into doing theater as an actor. But then I also went back to school. And I finished my degree, which I was able to do in 1 year. And what I found very quickly was that trying to act and hit the rehearsal schedules and performance schedules while also in school was a real problem.
Mm.
And so that was when I saw that there was a class that you were teaching that was all about stand-up comedy. And I thought, hey, I have this theater experience. I know how to get up on stage. And if I have a joke that doesn't land, I know how to keep going. So why don't I put my hat in the ring for that? And I did. I did not realize that we would end up doing shows and have all these open mics. I thought I was just going to take a 6-week class and, hey, I'll do some stand-up comedy, I guess.
Yeah, and I'm trying to remember back the first time you got up on a stage other than the class, and I want to say it was for Telly's. Does that sound right?
No, it was actually for Firestone or Firehouse in Anderson.
Oh, yeah, down in Anderson. Right.
I only had three minutes of material, but we had just had the class, and you were all like, hey, just come and do an open mic. And I said, sure, of course I will.
Well, yeah, and those classes were fun, you know. I mean, we met a lot of people, and most of them are still doing comedy. Some of them have kind of dropped out a little bit, but, I mean, you know what it's like when you have that performance bug that you have to satisfy, and you've certainly done that in the comedy world, but you've also done that as an actor, and not just an actor, right, Jeffrey? There's more to you than just acting when in that world.
Yeah, it's kind of a longish story that I don't want to necessarily tell the entire thing of, but the high schoolers at the Reading Performing Arts Center were doing Midsummer Night's Dream. The director didn't know the show super well and was looking for a cut of the show that would work for what her vision was. And I said, hey, look, I've directed this show twice before. I know it well. Why don't you just tell me what it is that you're looking for and I'll cut the show for you. Next thing you know, I'm assistant directing on that, which led to me directing a couple of shows, assistant directing again. And so I was just directing for a solid year there.
Wow.
And I had the acting bug again, so I went and auditioned at Shasta College. They were doing A Doll's House, which is a very meaty drama for any character that anybody could end up playing. And I felt really good about my audition, and apparently that was well-founded because I was cast and I was in that. Right now, I am set to be in three different shows, and some of them are conflicting with each other, so I've got some decisions to make.
Yeah, it's going to be like in those old sitcoms when, like, the person had to be in two places at the same time. So they'd run back and forth and change outfits or whatever. And I see you doing that. Running back and forth across the driveway or the parking lot to be two different characters, and forgetting that you have a mustache in one and you don't have a mustache in the other. That'd be very funny.
It's very much that Mrs. Doubtfire moment, for sure.
Yes, very much. That's good. So now I guess I didn't realize this. So when you first directed, it was Much Ado About Nothing. Is that what you said it was? What was the show you
no,
did?
No, I've not directed Much Ado. The first thing I ever directed was a play that I wrote in high school.
Oh, okay. So you had directed before.
I've directed probably about a dozen times at this point. But it was I was assistant directing on Midsummer Night's Dream with the high school students. And I knew the director very well because we had just done Hamlet together. And so she let me do whatever I wanted to do. I did direct half of that show.
Wow. That's great. So directing, acting, and I think, and you said you've done some writing. You said you directed a play that you had written, right?
I've written a couple of plays. It's been a long time. This was early on in high school and when college was just getting going for me. My freshman year, I did write a play, which I entered into a contest just because I had a play and there was a playwriting contest or a playwriting aspect to that contest, and I won first place.
Wow.
And I was already in the middle of directing and producing that show, so all the prize money went into props.
Oh, that's great. That's great. So this life of an entertainer, of a performer, whether it's acting or comedy or directing or whatever, how did that come about for you? Were you always was it always part of your makeup even as a child, or did you come to that a little older?
I think that even as a young child, like age 4 or 5, my father would play guitar and I would get up and sing and people would be like, hey, you're doing great with that. I mean, I was 4 or 5 years old. I'm sure that I was just a 4 or 5 year old who was very adamant that I was happy to be up in front of a crowd. But at the same time, I mean, even today, I'm a full-time substitute teacher. And so that is performing, I assure you.
Yeah. And so you're always in front of a crowd, and obviously...
I'm always in front of a crowd.
Yeah. And what do you like about that, about being in front of a crowd? Is there something that excites you about that?
I wish I could say that it's just something that excites me, but instead I have to say that it's something that I wanted to be excited about, and eventually I realized that I was getting good at it. Because I'm not, you know how sometimes with children or even teenagers, you get a sense of this raw talent. I work with a lot of teenagers, and I get a sense sometimes of, wow, you have this amazing raw talent for getting up in front of a crowd. And I did not have that. I had to learn that.
That's interesting. So when you say you had to learn that, you had to learn the skills that are necessary to be a performer? Is that what you're talking about?
I believe so, because when it comes to acting, for example, I did not come in with that raw talent that made me a really cool actor to work with early on. I was very apprehensive about things, and what it took was doing it, learning a lot of acting theory and theater theory so that I could then use that. And so I did take a very long hiatus because I had moved to Reading all the way back in 2006, and there was not a lot in the way of artistic endeavors that I could jump into. Then we moved to this somewhat rural area of Southern California, not even suburban, and there were very few opportunities there. So it wasn't until I moved back to Reading, suddenly there are 4 community theaters, and they're always looking for people. And so I jumped back into theater and realized, wow, I still have all this theory in my head, plus now I have all this life experience, and it's just a completely different thing than when I was young.
Yeah, So in terms of learning the skills or learning what you had to do to up your game, did you take classes? I know you took the comedy class, but in terms of acting and that whole side of things, did you take classes in acting?
Well, in college, I was originally a Shakespearean theater major, and I took all the acting classes, writing classes, directing classes.
Yeah, I know you love Shakespeare. Yeah. Yeah, you're like a major Shakespeare guy.
Well, I guess I'm sort of known for being the Shakespeare guy, which is why I'm currently in the middle. I'm going through this very slowly because I think it's necessary. I'm teaching myself everything there is to know about Shakespeare's sonnets.
Oh, nice.
Because if I'm going to be an expert on Shakespeare, I should know this stuff, right?
Right. That's right. Now, I actually, it's funny. I've only known one other friend who was probably as deep into Shakespeare as you are. And this was the guy that I actually started doing comedy with. We did a comedy duo kind of a thing, and way back in the day, late 70s, basically. And that's when we were hitting like the Comedy Store and the Improv and all that down in L.A. But he was like you, just totally immersed in the world of Shakespeare. So it's been kind of fun to sort of revisit some of that in talking with you and watching what you do and hearing your thoughts on Shakespeare. What is it about Shakespeare that is intriguing to you?
Well, I think it started for me. I saw my sister in A Midsummer Night's Dream when I was maybe 9 years old, and where I grew up in Western Massachusetts, far away from Boston, mind you, literally as far away as you can be and still be in the state, like in the northwest corner in Williamstown, Massachusetts. There's a big theater scene there, but also Shakespeare and Company, which is like the Oregon Shakespeare Festival of New England, were very prevalent there, and they were working with every fourth grade class to put on a Shakespeare play where I think we had four different teachers, and so they would break the play up into four different sections, and kids would play for one scene a character from, in my case, it was Romeo and Juliet, so I played Lord Capulet as in Romeo and Juliet. And that was the beginning of it for me. And somehow Shakespeare just made sense. It's kind of like how I can have an appreciation of Melville, but I'm not so much appreciative of Hawthorne, even though they're contemporaries if you're thinking of terms in like Moby Dick and The Scarlet Letter.
Right, yeah. Two very different works.
Very, very different works because here's the thing. Melville didn't claim to have any of the answers, and Hawthorne claimed to have all the answers. And so that's why I think I like Melville more.
That's good. Because that's kind of like you. You like to think you have all the answers, right? Isn't that something about your personality?
No, it's the other way around, because when I directed Twelfth Night, which I just did last summer, some of the actors that I worked with did not appreciate my approach to it, because I was trying to help them find where the truth of the scene was, rather than telling them what I thought the truth of the scene was.
Well, but isn't that that's the mark of a great director? I mean, you know, I've done some acting, like commercials and so forth, and, you know, probably the better directors that I ever worked with, they obviously had a vision for whatever the commercial was. You know, when we sell the soap, we have to sell the soap this way, you know. But you know, there were at least a handful of directors who, they didn't come out and say whatever you want, but they wanted to see what I would bring to the role. And, you know, they were eager to help me if it wasn't right. You know, no, what I want is this. But at least they were opening the door for the artist in me to step through, you know.
Right, and I certainly appreciate that you just called me a great director. No, that I had the mark of a great director. But what I had said in the director's notes, and this was very much true, was that the entire theme of the rehearsal process was, yes, let's try that. So anytime that an actor would come to me with an idea, I would say, yes, let's try that. And if it worked, great. We would use it. We would refine it maybe. But if it didn't work, we would either maybe rework it. We might throw it away. I had a million ideas, that some of which never became a thing.
And that idea of, yeah, let's try it, isn't that kind of a hallmark or a tenet of improv, right?
Right. So yeah, so somebody says, hey, we're in a coffee shop. You don't say, no, we're in a elementary school playground. You have to say, yes, we're in a coffee shop, and it's next to an elementary school playground.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
With stand-up, I know that we all have our different approaches. For me, I tend to go somewhat scripted, but I write the script.
Well, yeah, and you are a strong writer, and I think maybe your acting background, it was true for me that my acting background and having worked with so many scripts in that world or written some, that there's a natural ability as a writer. Okay, I'm writing drama today, and tomorrow I'm writing comedy. So if I'm going to write comedy, what are the steps I need to take to write effective comedy? And I think, you know, I mean, I'm sure you will agree with this. You don't just grab your pen and start writing and it's gold out of the gate. We need to edit things, and we need to, you know, read them out loud or even record them and see, is this working as stand-up, right?
Right. And so in the same way that I really celebrate some stand-ups like Mike Birbiglia, for example, or even Jim Jefferies, who is not a clean comic in any sense of the word, but he's good at storytelling. And so that was my first thought when I came into stand-up, that I wanted to be a storyteller that would tell stories and then harken back and, you know, have fun with things in that way. But a lot of what I've been working on lately are essentially one-liners.
Yeah, and there's a big call for that. I mean, you know, audiences are so fickle sometimes. There are audiences who, I'm basing this on my experience, but also people I've watched, you know, their specials or whatever. And there's some audiences who really go along with us for a long story. I'm thinking of, like, you know, Nate Bargatze, who he's a long storyteller.
Love him.
But he peppers his stories along the way with, you know, homespun humor that people will laugh at. It's not always a huge payoff at the end, but you've been laughing all along. So let's talk about comedy a little bit. So you had the acting thing going on, and you came back to Reading and got involved in the local theater scene here. And then was that when you took my class and kind of got interested in comedy, was that kind of the first time you looked at that seriously about doing stand-up?
That's absolutely correct, because I had never done stand-up comedy. I mean, it's one of those things. A lot of people will be told, hey, you're really funny, you should do stand-up. But doing stand-up is not the same thing as just being funny when you're in a group of friends, or if you're in a leadership role in a small group and you start riffing on something and they find it funny. For stand-up, at least from my experience of it, it really is about scripting things, and it really is about editing down, making things as simple as they possibly can be, so that you're not overwhelming the audience with a ton of superfluous information.
You know, I'm really glad that you said that. I mean, all of that, but especially how you started out by saying, you know, being the funny person in the room is very different than getting up and performing as a stand-up comic. And I think a lot of people who want to go down this path of being a comedian, a stand-up comedian, they either – there are people who just ignore that wisdom. And they think, well, I'm funny at the party, so I'll just get up and be funny. And, you know, they either learn right away that that ain't going to work, or they discover – or they don't care, and they think, well, I'm going to go on the mic, you know, at the local open mic and just spew what I think is funny, and I don't care if people like me or not because I got this great job, and this isn't my career, you know. And so it does take I think it takes a sense of professionalism to approach this wacky thing of stand-up comedy as serious business, as corny as that might sound, you know.
It's a different thing for me because I also do a podcast. My podcast has a couple of hundred episodes.
Nice.
And a big part of what the draw is that my co-host and I, we know each other really well. We both have theatrical backgrounds, and a lot of what we do is we improv back and forth. Now, we have a very serious set of things that we try to do every time that we have an episode, because it's all, for us, it's about Superman, because we both love Superman. And what we end up doing is cracking jokes back and forth to each other, and we're very quick, but that's improv. It's completely different from getting up on your own and being in front of an audience. You can't edit later and saying, here's material that I have written and I'm going to perform it as though I'm performing it the first time because you got to keep it fresh, right?
Yes,
Same thing in theater.
absolutely. Yes.
Any audience that's coming in is seeing it for the first time. So you can't just be like, okay, we've done this a million times. Let's do it for the millionth time. You gotta keep it fresh. And that's a big part of what that comes down to.
I was trying to remember just now as you were saying that. I know there was at least one and maybe two commercials that I did where I wasn't delivering the line the way the director of that commercial wanted. And that happens, obviously. But I wasn't delivering it for like, I don't know, 20 or 25 takes or something. It was a long time. And it was something like, yes, I use that on my stairs. It was some kind of a dumb line that anybody could really say, but for whatever reason, I wasn't capturing it. But on that 25th take, like you just said so perfectly, it had to sound like it was fresh out of my head. It was the first time I'd said that. And when as I relate that to comedy, I think you've probably seen me perform, one of my hits when I do a riff on that old song from the 70s, A Horse with No Name.
I love that one.
Thank you. And I've done that. I've performed that bit for, gosh, 15, 20 years, And I don't know how many times I've actually gotten up at the end of a long show and performed that, but it's been many, many times, hundreds of times. And every time I do it, what's in my head so strong is this has to look like it's the first time I came up with what looks like an off-the-cuff comment in the middle of the bit, And that's where my acting chops come in because as an actor, you learn that kind of stuff, like you just said.
Yeah, and there are two things that I can say about that. The first is that the last play that I was in, there was one line that I had that I did not know how to deliver. Like, I thought I had my mind around it, but the director kept giving me notes, and I was trying to follow the director's notes. And this director was really giving me carte blanche to come up with my own ideas, show them to him. I stopped telling him that I was going to try something new and just went to show it to him when we were in rehearsal. And he was like, yes, I like that, do that. But then there was this one line, and the line was simply, there you go. And he was like, you're not delivering that properly. And I couldn't figure out what it is that he wanted. I finally did. I think by the second performance, the first performance, I still didn't have it
That's
right.
funny.
But I finally figured out what it was that he was looking for. But it's just a very, very simple one line. There you go.
Yeah, I think one of the things I love that I've always loved about live entertainment, whether it's theater or comedy or even music or whatever, is that there's always the chance that something might go wrong. And so then you need to figure out as the performer, how to fix that. I will never forget, I told you on a Facebook chat that I had played Mr. Beaver in a Narnia show that we did when I was in high school. And
And
so
I played Aslan in high school, and right now I am doing all the stage combat for this group of kids. They're 5th through 8th graders at the Reading Performing Arts Center. It's looking incredible.
oh, I'm sure it is. You've done that before, the combat training thing. And but when I was Mr. Beaver in this play, I remember that, and you know the show or the book at least. So, at some point in like the second act, I think it was the second act, early on, I made as Mr. Beaver, I jumped to the third act when Edmund has gone away to go be with the White Witch. So I started saying lines like, "Well, what about Edmund? What are we going to do about Edmund?" And Edmund's sitting right there in the room, and so the other cast members had to think quickly and, well, Edmund's sitting right here. Well, yes, he is. Okay. And, I totally blanked and was in the third act already. So, nerves kicked in, which was kind of
Yeah,
funny.
it's one of those things you have to acknowledge when something doesn't go right.
Yeah.
And it doesn't mean that you have to say, hey, that was wrong. It just means that you have to acknowledge something and move forward. And that's a thing that can be learned from theater. I remember seeing a version of Two Gentlemen of Verona, which is a Shakespeare, and there's a dog in it, and they decided to use a real dog. At some point, the dog was off stage, and you could hear the dog barking, and the actors decided, we're just going to ignore this.
Yeah.
And just keep moving forward. No, if you acknowledge it, then it's acknowledged.
Yeah, because the audience can hear the dog barking, right?
Right.
Yeah, right.
And that's what you have to do. And so I was in a show a couple of years ago. It was a four-person show, Neil Simon. It was called Chapter 2.
Oh, yeah.
And at one point, I'm in the middle of this scene that's all about telling plot. And so it's a very difficult scene. And there are so many scenes in this show where the phone's supposed to ring. And the phone is not supposed to ring in this scene. We're in the middle of the scene. The phone rings once. And so I stop and I pick up the phone. No, sorry, wrong number. Put it back down. Continue the scene.
That's funny.
It's the same thing with stand-up comedy. If things start going wrong, you just have to acknowledge it. And there was only one time that I honestly feel as though I bombed on stage. And it was because I was maybe 6 weeks in to doing stand-up. And I think the reason why I bombed is because I just started going faster and faster. I thought, I have a limited amount of time. I want to tell all of these jokes.
That's great.
And I learned from that just slow down. And if I don't get to all the jokes, that's not the end of the world, as long as the jokes that I'm telling land.
Right. That's a really good point. I remember early on, I do have a tendency to talk very fast. And when I first started doing stand-up, I would talk very fast. And I would get to the end of a joke and pretty much lickety-split get right into the next joke. And one of my frustrations was, I'm not hearing people laugh enough. And I talked to my wife about that, and she said, "Well, you're not talking slow enough for them to even get the joke. You know, you're moving on to something else." And so I took that to heart, but I really took it to heart because I was forced to talk slow. I was in Denver for a long time, so Mile High City, and I worked a show in. What was the name of the play? Well, it was basically the 2 mile high city, 10,000 feet. I can't think of the name of the city right now, but it's up there. And I had to slow down when I was performing because I couldn't breathe. You know, I didn't have any oxygen. So I had to stop and slow down. And the great lesson I learned there, was let's say I had, 20 minutes of material, but I could stretch it easily to 40 because I had to breathe. So before we go, I want to. Yeah. Thank you for laughing at my pain. That's not, so. So before we go, I want to talk more about comedy and your path of doing stand up. Because you've been at this for a while. I know you've been back and forth with stand up and also acting. But so you decided to take my class and you learned stuff about doing stand up. And since then, what have you been doing with stand-up? What's your path been like?
Well, I'm definitely, in my case, I'm treating it much more like a hobby. I'm not treating it as though I'm looking to get the Netflix or HBO special. At the same time, if I do continue and get to that point, I feel like I could do a good job with that, but it's not an actual goal. And that's one of the things that we talked about back in that class, is about having goals. And I realized early on that, okay, I need to make sure that my goals are realistic and that my goals are things that I am very confident about doing, because I am confident that I could get to that place. But it's just that I am focused on different things right now, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I think that's great. Yeah, totally makes sense. One thing I appreciate about you, Jeffrey, is that, there are some comedians who will say, like, if I'm producing a show and I want it to be a clean show or a family friendly show or rated PG or whatever, the terminology we use, and they'll say, no, I can't do that. I just can't work clean. That's not inside of me. And I'm never going to do that and blah, blah, blah. And that's fine. That's their stance. But one thing I appreciate about you is that you You've been able to adjust what you do to fit the either the parameters of the venue or the expectations of the venue or the producer. And not everybody can do that. So I really appreciate that.
I think a big part of that comes from, again, very early on with doing stand-up. This would have been at least a year and a half ago, and I've been doing this for under 2 years, that I was invited to a showcase. It was at the Shack Social. And that same director that I worked with for Midsummer Night's Dream, who's a director and an actress that I worked with and highly respect, and her boyfriend, who I also have a huge amount of respect for and he respects me, they came to see that show. And it was not a PG show. My stuff is PG-13, and I dial it back to PG because that's just the way that I want to go about it, right? I don't feel as though I need to go into the hard R rating in order to be funny.
Right.
But at the same time, I will mention that if I am in an R-rated venue, I'll maybe drop an F-bomb.
Right.
Like, that's as far R as I go. And so these two people, they're a couple, and they have not seen a lot of stand-up comedy, as far as I'm aware, but they're big into theater, and we've had so many conversations about theater and things like that. But they were not enjoying the show until I got on. I was like the sixth person on, and then suddenly I got up, and I was doing my PG-13 stuff, and they were laughing hysterically, and they thought that I was doing a great job. But the stuff before that, a lot of it was, some of it was funny, even though it was hard R rating. Some of it was gross out humor, but some of it was gross out humor, and the entire comedy about it was the gross out.
Right, right.
And that's what they didn't appreciate.
Yeah.
And so they were not enjoying themselves until I got up on stage, and I'm not trying to toot my own horn for that. It was just the nature of the way that things were going at that time for that evening for that group of people.
Yeah, comedy, stand-up comedy is an interesting thing because, you know, we have this whole, as a performer, as a comic, you have that whole freedom of speech thing that lies at the base of who we are. And, you know, we say, I should be allowed to get up on a stage and say whatever I want, blah, blah, blah. And I do like that. I do support that. But I always lean first towards funny. If what I'm saying isn't funny, it doesn't matter how clean or how vulgar I get. If it's not funny, then it's not, to me, it's not stand-up comedy. It maybe it's something else. Like you've heard me say, maybe it's a TED Talk, or maybe it's something else, you know, but it's not stand-up.
I have said to you at a stand-up show, this person who's up on stage right now is not doing stand-up. They're doing a TED Talk.
Right, right, right. And I get it. I get people want to do that. But it, you know, for me, if the banner outside says, hey, enjoy a night of comedy, you'll laugh really hard, you know, and then people come in and they're being hit over the head with politics or vulgarity or something, you know, something that's not really a joke. To me, I feel like we've failed. I think our goal as comedians is to bring laughter. You know, people want to laugh. That's why they came to the comedy show and sometimes even paid good money to come to the comedy show. You know, 10, 20, 30 bucks or whatever it is and or more if you're like a top talent. Anyway, but so again, I do appreciate that you've always been able to adjust and bend with what you do. This is probably going to be published out there in the world for people to hear in the next week or so. So what do you have coming up that you can, you know, promo? Tell us about.
Okay, at this point, I have not been officially cast in The Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder, which will be at the Reading Performing Arts Center, I want to say sometime in March, but I know that negotiations were made because they also asked me to be in May We All, which is a country musical, and I took on a smaller role. I think they wanted me for something a little bit bigger, but based on that negotiation, I'm playing the mayor.
That's perfect. That's a great role for you. I can see you doing that.
Yeah, I was often cast as like the king and everything back in high school and college. Anytime there was a king character, like I said, I played Aslan.
Yeah,
and in Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And so it was helpful going into this show, the kids show, where I already knew the story really, really well.
That's great. That's
Because
great.
I've read the entire Chronicles of Narnia. I love C.S. Lewis. I've read a ton of C.S.
Oh,
Lewis.
yeah. I love that you're busy, that you're working, whether it's acting or, comedy or whatever. And I think it's so great. And I just want to thank you so much for spending time with me talking about your life as an actor and entertainer and comedian. It's been great to catch up with you this way. And because, we don't really get that much time to talk. We pass each other in hallways at the comedy club or the theater or whatever. But this is nice to actually have a sit down and.
Ships passing in the night.
Right. Yes. Ships passing in the night. Yeah. Well, Jeffrey Taylor, it's been great talking with you. And how can people find you if they want to find more about you?
Primarily, I did have multiple social media things went back when I was a professional writer for a while, and I still have some of those things open, but I don't use them or check them. Primarily for me on Facebook, you can look for Jeffrey Taylor, and I'm often in shows at the Reading Performing Arts Center or working on something there at the Reading Performing Arts Center. In fact, if you see a show at the Reading Performing Arts Center, in all likelihood, either my wife or I are involved in some way. Just look through. There's me and there's Megan Owens. The other ways to find me, there is my podcast, From Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast. We can be found most of the ways that you can find Superman podcasts. We do have a number, or find any podcast, rather, but we do have a number of episodes out, and if you're not necessarily just a huge Superman fan, you want to check in to see what I've done, take a look at the interview episodes. Because there are far too many of them to just go through, unless you're a gigantic Superman fan like my co-host Michael Bailey and I are. But we are taking a little bit of a break on that because Michael Bailey needs to take a break on that. I've had to take a break, then he had to take a break. But that show is far from being over.
It's so great that you're doing that podcast. And again, look how busy you are doing all this great stuff. And yet, in all the busyness, you took time out of your Sunday morning to come and talk with me about, entertainment and comedy and acting and all that. So that's been really great. Jeffrey, it's been great to have you as part of this podcast. I'm grateful for your talent and your friendship and your availability. And folks, make sure you check out Jeffrey Taylor. Jeffrey, have a great rest of the day.
Oh, you as well. Have a great rest of your day, rest of your week. Happy Thanksgiving.
Yes, happy Thanksgiving to you and to everybody listening. Well, thanks for listening to this episode of Just Pure Laughs. My guest today was Jeffrey Taylor, actor, director, stand-up comic, and all-around swell guy. Be listening to future episodes where we will talk more about comedy and specifically clean comedy and how it can help bring hope to a world desperately in need of hope. See you next time.